Hi, Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Commercial air travel began in the 1920s, but it was in the 1950s and 60s when people en masse took to the skies. At that time and into the 1970s, planes were luxurious. People dressed for the occasion, and it was expensive. We get a glimpse into that world with Anne Hood and her new memoir, Fly Girl. She's the author of The Book That Matters Most, The Red Thread, and The Knitting Circle, among others. Welcome back, Anne. It's been a while.
So great to see you. It sure has. I'm sorry I'm not in beautiful Woods Hole with you, but this will do. Next time.
So the new book is about your experiences as a flight attendant in the late 1970s into the mid 80s. Who knew you had this other life before your writing, right? I love in the prologue you write, a friend of mine recently said to me, I love when you start a story with when I was a flight attendant, because I know it's going to be a good story. At dinner or cocktail parties, when someone asks what I do, they often look at me blankly when I say that I am a writer. Have I read anything by you, they ask, often accompanied with a narrowing of the eyes, or have you published anything? Sometimes even people I know ask me if I'm still writing, as if it's a hobby and not a career. But once I say those magic words, when I was a flight attendant, everyone is interested.
True. You know, I'm surprised I didn't think of writing this book sooner, because that has been the case ever since I been a flight attendant and been a writer. But sometimes it takes a while for you to realize, as I did, that something you did in your life actually had some historical context. You know, for me, it was my job for 8 years, and I loved it. It empowered me as a woman. People think it does the opposite and sort of, the glorified waitress sex kitten stereotype, but it actually is a very empowering job. And it took me years to realize that I was lucky enough to fly during the golden age of travel, the golden age of aviation as it was waning, but still in effect. And I stopped when things were changing to what we are used to now.
I know today, yeah. Yeah. So interesting, in 1965, only 20% of Americans had flown. I hadn't realized that, but it was expensive, right?
It was so expensive.
Yeah, and I think some of us of a certain age remember some. I remember the champagne flights to Florida on Delta Airlines.
Wow, do you? That's great.
70s, yeah.
Yeah, I love all that stuff.
Yeah. So you had this grand plan to become a stewardess, and travel. You wanted to travel the world, have these adventures, and then write novels about your travels and adventures.
Right.
And when you shared with your junior high school teacher, Mr. Stone, that you wanted to be a writer, he said, "Anne, people don't do that." you write, "Then I want to be an airline stewardess," I announced. Mr. Stone peered out at me from behind his aviator glasses and said, "Anne, smart girls do not become airline stewardesses." But yeah. Mr. Stone was dead wrong. Some smart girls do become airline stewardesses and writers. And after my first flight, I knew I would be one of them. So take us back to that first flight.
Oh boy, yes. The first time I flew as a passenger, I was 17 years old. I had been, and listeners are going to know this because it was a big New England thing. I was a Marsha Jordan girl for the Jordan Marsh department stores. And basically there were 8 or 10 of us high school girls. And we walked around in the new clothes and we did big back to school special programming. And they were almost like ambassadors, not unlike being a flight attendant in a strange way. And I saved so much money. I made so much money doing it and I saved it all up. And one of my best friends, Nancy, worked at the Newport Creamery scooping ice cream. And she also had a big bank account. We decided we were going to go somewhere. And our junior high French teacher had become a travel agent. And we went to see him knowing he'd, send us somewhere safe and fun and cheap. And we went to Bermuda on Delta, actually, $99 round trip from Logan. And I stepped on that plane and I already had in my head that I wanted to do this job. When I took that flight, the deal was sealed. I just remember watching them. They looked wholesome. They weren't like big sex pots, like Coffee Tea or Me had told me. Mm-hmm. And the food was lovely in its little compartments. And I remember when I discovered you could move the air jet and get like a little breeze on your face. And then, 2 hours later or something, we're in this tropical paradise. We had left Boston, Logan Airport, traffic. And here we are in Hamilton, Bermuda at this big pink hotel. And I was like, this is what I want to do. I want to get on a plane in Boston or somewhere and step off it in someplace exotic and wonderful. So that sealed the deal for me.
And you just said the food was lovely. People are like, what? But the food was, right? I mean, there was some high-end food back then on the planes.
It was amazing. So people still can't believe this. My editor's assistant who helped with the editing of the book, she kept saying, are you kidding? Like notes. And one of her big surprises was that on a transcontinental flight, so from New York to San Francisco or Boston to LA or something, in coach, you did a liquor service and there was little nuts or something. Then you came through with appetizers, these skewers with mozzarella and tomatoes and that and more cocktails. I mean, they had to pay for them, unlike in first class. You handed out menus, choice of three entrees in coach, and you served them that. And then you came through with TWA mints on a silver tray. And then there was an after dinner drink service where we took that liquor cart back out, put dry ice on the top, poured some water on it, and like a cloud emerges. So we walked like through a fog, serving Galliano and Amaretto and all these horrible things. But yeah, yeah. I mean, that was in coach.
That's what it was, yeah.
And now you don't even get a meal, or you can buy, you know, the hard cheese tray or whatever.
Yeah, a little bag of pretzels, yeah. So. But people dressed up back then too, right? I mean, you didn't get on a plane in your sweatpants.
No, I mean, honestly, I couldn't prove this, like I couldn't find anything, and I looked, but in my memory, and people out there, if you know this too, like let us know, you could be denied boarding if you like had on flip-flops or you looked messy or something. I remember being in Phoenix where they didn't let a guy on because he was dressed inappropriately. And I don't remember what he had, because that would be like the gate agent thing, but there was a big to-do, like they're not letting him board because he he's not really clean and he's not dressed up.
Yeah. And talk about what the they were called stewardesses then, but flight attendants, they all had these, that was one of the things you loved was the uniform, right?
Oh my gosh, you bet. So they changed the name. So TWA called their stewardesses hostesses, because their idea was, it's like you're welcoming people into your home. So it was TWA hostesses, but the general term was stewardess. That changed just a few years before I started flying to flight attendants. And that was because after Pan Am lost a suit to keep men out, men started becoming flight, so they had to get a neutral term. That's why flight attendant started, but just a few years before I started. So I never got to be a stewardess. I was a flight attendant, but I was right on the border, right? And the good thing was I missed, or maybe it's not, it would have been fun, paper uniforms TWA had for a while. They only lasted, I think they had to get rid of them in about 9 months because they tore so easily. You know, flight attendants were always like kind of doing a uniform adjustments. Braniff had the striptease that they did in the aisle, changing their clothes four times until they ended up in like, you know, like hot pants and whatever. But I happened to be the first class of TWA, and TWA was the first in the industry to go back to the old kind of military inspired uniform. So all of the uniforms were designed by big designers like Pucci or Halston. Ralph Lauren designed the TWA uniform. It was beautiful, this elegant, like double breasted jacket, skirt, or pants. You know, we could wear pants also, with a kind of crisp white shirt and the maroon and navy scarf. And it had like little stripes on the sleeve that were maroon, and our lipstick was supposed to match the stripes.
And yeah, you walk through the airport terminals feeling pretty proud. And at that time too, pilots were, I mean, it's still a prestigious job, but it was very prestigious, right? To be a pilot back then.
Oh my goodness. I have so many memories of being, when I flew international on mostly 747. So that's a big crew of flight attendants. And there used to be three in the cockpit, flight engineer, first officer, and captain, right? And so for like 15 or 16 of us in our beautiful uniforms to get off a plane and walk through the airport in Cairo or Paris or wherever, little kids especially, their heads would turn, and like it was really something to see. Now you see a crew and they look so beleaguered often, you know. I mean, the job has changed so much, mostly because of deregulation, which I write about to explain what's happened. But that deregulation started in 1978, but it took a few years for the impact to start to be felt. And then, of course, that once it started, it just kept snowballing. But those were the days of like really feeling grand.
Well, you write in your book that you wanted to be an airline stewardess since you were 11 years old, and you read a 1964 book called How to Become an Airline Stewardess by Katherine Kaysen.
Yeah. So, you know, I was an avid reader, and I would go to the library, and just typically I took big, heavy novels out because I could only go to the library once a week. So I wanted books that lasted. But this paperback, like on the little spinny case, caught my eye. I have a copy of it, actually. I tracked it down several years ago, How to Become an Airline Stewardess. And the first line is something like, would you like a boyfriend in every city in the world? Like, yeah, I'm 11. I live in West Warwick, Rhode Island. I would like that. Yeah. And the book, oh my God, talk about sexism. You know, it talks about how you're never going to be, you know, in management, but who wants to be when you're going to marry a businessman? You know, it's just, it's really a fascinating read of a capsule of 1964 and the mentality that not just men had toward women, but women had toward women, right?
And there was also the Coffee, Tea, or Me book that was similar.
Oh boy, so that book was the pen name of two women who apparently flew for, I think it was Eastern Airlines. It was actually an American Airlines marketing guy who wrote it. And the draw, it's worth looking at just for the drawings alone of the busty, they're kind of sketches, you know, the busty flight attendant and the businessman with their eyes kind of popping out, you know, and the adventures of these invented people.
Yeah. And at that time, men called all the shots and the rules were quite different than they are today, right? You had to be single, weigh no more than 115 pounds, and be no taller than 5'4".
Yeah, those were the original rules that expanded a bit in the 60s. They became, you had to stop flying when you're 32, because as TWA famously said, if a man doesn't want you by then, TWA sure doesn't.
Yeah, crazy.
And, yeah, right? And then they realized that women needed, or flight attendants or stewardesses, whatever, needed to be taller to reach emergency equipment and stuff. As jets got bigger, they had to let us be taller. And they had a weight chart, you know, if you were 5'7", you could weigh this much, you know, so big weight charts, you had to match that. It started that you had to quit when you were 32 or got married. Flight attendants are strong women and they fought to change all this. It took decades. Once they changed the marriage rule, then it was, you had to quit if you had children. And that did not get, they did not win that case until the 80s.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah, when you think
crazy.
About that.
Yeah.
But it was kind of thought of as like the marriage market, right? That was
absolutely.
Like, yeah. I mean, stewardesses thought that, the management thought that. It was like,
yeah.
you're there to find a husband.
Yeah, I think it was.
You were not though.
No, I wasn't. And many of the people I flew with were not, because by the time I started, so 1978, I got hired. I cannot say that it was an enlightened era. There was still a lot of the sexism and a lot of the stereotypes existed, but things were starting to change. But it was still a time when people went to college. I literally sat with friends of mine who said about their college experience, I came for an MRS. You know, so there was still that mentality for many women. Other women had changed their minds. And it changed from, I think, an average flight attendant stayed for an average of like a year and a half to 2 years, because then they got married and had to quit. But by the time I started flying, people were married. It was considered more of a career. And I also knew a lot of couples who were married, you know, who that was their career. And some of them did it until they retired. So that did start to change. But again, not until the late 70s. Yeah.
Yeah. We're talking with Ann Hood. Her new book is Fly Girl. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have a question or you'd like to add to the story. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Ann Hood. Her new book is Fly Girl. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. What also I love about the book is it's not just your experiences, but you touch a little on some of the history. And actually, the very first flight attendant was a man.
Yes. Yeah. It was he worked for a German airline. And really all of the airlines we know now, you know, United, TWA, Pan Am, you know, they first used men as well because they modeled their service after the way ships did. And so everybody dressed like a ship's captain. And actually a lot of the words we still use on airplanes come from ships. Like the pilot is called a captain. We cook in a galley. You know, there's a lot, it's lasted for a long time, but they were sons of investors. And they thought they needed men for a lot of reasons, because flying was dangerous. Men made, they thought made passengers feel safer, like they were more confident with men. But Ellen Church, this
woman,
the first flight attendant, as you know, first stewardess, marched in and she had a pilot's license. She actually could fly an airplane. They would not let her in the cockpit. They would not let her fly. So she was a nurse and she convinced them that having nurses on board would help their business. And she was right, and it did. And you had to be a nurse until World War II. And when the nurses then had to, you know, help with the war effort, that's when it changed to anybody could become a flight attendant.
Yeah, and she was quite convincing, right? I mean, at first when she was saying a nurse, they're like, yeah, I don't know. But she convinced them, and
she was saying we could take care of sick passengers, and which was everybody, because they flew below 10,000 feet, and it was
at that time, right?
Air sick bags were like really a.
You don't see them anymore. I was gonna say, I was thinking the last time I flew, I went, whatever happened to the air sick bags? I mean, you don't need them anymore, I guess.
No, you know, and I noticed that too. I have to say, there are still people get air sick, so I don't know what happens anymore. Yeah. But I used to always take notes on them if I needed. I used to have paper in the seat. Yeah.
Let's talk to Ian, who's giving us a call from Hyannis. Hi, Ian.
Hello. I'm the son of a stewardess who was in the second Pan Am class just after World War II.
Wow.
And her career only lasted, I think, 18 months because... she married a handsome young pilot who was my father.
You know, Ian, that is a classic story. That's the classic story of those early stewardesses.
Oh, yeah. The town of Setauket that I grew up in was kind of a Pan Am ghetto, and all around us were former students, stewardesses who were the mothers, and all the fathers were pilots.
Wow. Where was that?
Setauket, Long Island.
Long Island, of course, so they were near the airport. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, because we flew first seaplanes out of LaGuardia and then, the DC-7 and DC-6 and DC-7 out of what's now Kennedy, Idlewild then.
Yeah. Ian, did she save any of her stuff, like her uniform or any, do you have any memorabilia?
I don't have it. Mom didn't keep any of her uniforms. They were pretty classy. Tripp, who owned Pan American, was very, you know, it was like the pilot's uniform in that it was kind of modeled on Navy uniforms.
Okay.
It was fairly much like the what the Waves wore during the war.
Right. And gotcha.
Back when Mom was hired, you had to be beautiful, of course, but then. You had to have two languages besides English, and nurse training was a definite plus. Mom also had a four-engine license, so she had an extra plus.
He sounds like some woman. Wow.
Yeah. Ian, thanks for sharing. You're going to have to read this book. It'll be you'll enjoy it, I'm sure. Ian,
I've written it down. I'm definitely going to, next time I'm at Yellow Umbrella, I will pick it up.
Get it. Okay. Thanks, Ian. Thanks for the phone call. We have Janet giving us a call from Martha's Vineyard. Hi, Janet.
Hi. My mother was an airline stewardess, and at that time she had to be a nurse. And flew with TWA, and I have her original letter of being accepted in my hand.
Oh,
says, you will be interested to know that you are one of 60 selected from over 2,000 applicants.
Wow.
And it lists all the things that she would be eligible for. You wouldn't believe the amounts. It says, during the training at Kansas City of not to exceed 4 weeks, the student hostess received no salary, but we received $2.50 per day living expenses, $4 if away from Kansas City. And then it goes on and on about her... clothing and all that sort of stuff. It's unbelievable, but I have it all. And she also had her picture in Life magazine.
Really? What year was that? What year did she fly?
The date on this letter is November 18th, 1935, and as far as Life magazine, was March 29th, 1937. And it was an article about, you know, airline stewardesses and how they married. And they didn't last long because they married the pilots, and that's what my mother did.
That's what your mother did, too.
Another one. Thanks for sharing. That's awesome.
That is great.
It's like a historical document.
That's great. 866-999-4626 is our number, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. By the time you were there, Anne, though, the pilots were a little bit older, right? I mean,
TWA, like some newer airlines had young pilots because they were starting up and, you know, they needed to hire people. But we had, most of our pilots had flown in the early 60s in the Vietnam War and had transitioned to commercial airlines. So they were older. They were sort of like your uncle or, you know, the guy down the street or not dating material, let's say that. Yeah. And most of them were married to former flight attendants.
Right. So Janet mentioned her mom was one of 60 out of 2000. And the interview process is pretty intense. Talk about the interview process. And you so wanted TWA, United, or Pan Am.
Yep.
That was it. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, I had just finished college and the interview process, and I will say the training were harder than in those short periods were harder than all 4 years of my college combined. So there was always a preliminary interview where basically you just kind of walked. I mean, they were checking you out. Probably I wasn't aware of that. I was so nervous. I thought they just wanted to make sure I could walk cleanly and like down an aisle of an airplane, you know. But a friend of mine who flew in the 40s said her entire interview was them checking out her legs, and she knew it. And she's like, if that's what it takes, I'm going to get what I want, you know? So the preliminary interview just had to kind of make chit chat, called for a second interview. For some airlines, there were only two, but most of the bigger ones, you had three. The second one was with a group and then also an individual one. Then the third one, TWA, was arguably the hardest in that you had to fly to Kansas City and be at the training center for 3 days. And you were scrutinized from morning until night. And it was everything from psychological testing and medical testing and math testing. And because you did have to perform some pretty easy math, but they still, you know, we still had to be tested, to role playing and having you mix with people. They watched you do everything. It was nerve wracking. But I was delighted when I got that letter a week later, like Janet's mother's letter, you know, you get that envelope and it's so exciting.
Yeah, but it's almost like, you know, you're applying to these different airlines. It's almost like waiting for your college admissions, right? Letters to come.
You nailed it. My daughter just went through that. And more than once, I thought about holding my breath, waiting. You know, they said it would be a week or a month. And where is it? And, you know, what's the news going to be?
All right. So evidently you were what they were looking for because you had to choose between TWA and United. Mm-hmm. And at the time, TWA was struggling a little bit financially. Your friend urged you to go with United, but you're 21 years old and you're like, I want to see the world and adventure. I'm doing TWA. And that was a lot of the process, right? You have to look, where are these airlines based? Where are you going to be? Where do they fly? Right?
Yes. Right. So United at the time, it's hard to imagine because they've become such a big international airline. They flew, I think the only place they flew that was even far was Hawaii. And they told me right up front, you're going to be based in Cleveland. I was like, I don't know. And, you know, you did a lot of those little hops, and they were a beautiful airline and their flight attendants looked so professional. Like when I got hired by them, it was right before I heard from TWA, but I would have been happy to do it. However, I was still holding out for that international airline. And as you said, TWA struggled financially forever. Howard Hughes bought them back in the 40s or 50s, and he was rich, but it was like his playground. TWA was his playground. So they weren't very stable because he would just throw money here and there. And they never really were an airline that was making a lot of money. Somebody said, and I quoted in the book, but something like the perpetually financially unstable TWA started every newscast about TWA.
Yeah. So, and you know, you're hired, but it's not over yet. You got this probation period, which was intense.
Oh my God. We lived in fear for six months. So it was first 6 weeks of grueling training, you know, And again, listen, I understand this was pretty cushy. It wasn't like some jobs that people have to do. And I understand that. But it was, you know, long hours and a lot of learning about things that I really knew nothing about, like evacuating airplanes. And TWA had a huge fleet. So there were 7 different kinds of airplanes. So you had to learn evacuation, safety stuff, service, everything about each airplane. Like you had to be intimate with it because when you got off, when you graduated, you were typically on reserve, which meant you just got a call, go to the airport and, you know, here's your flight. And you could show up and work a tiny plane like a DC-9 with 89 people or a Lockheed 1011 with hundreds of people. And you had to be able right away to remember and know what to do on each of those for both emergency stuff and service stuff. And for 6 months, you were still being scrutinized. You'd walk off a plane and they had a scale down the steps. So the passengers in the jetway couldn't see it, but we knew it was down there. And you know, the crooked finger beckoning to you and you were weighed and it was recorded. And my dear roommate was fired for being 5 pounds overweight.
Fired for 5 pounds overweight. That's just so insane, right? And you also had like you, what you called onions, what passenger complaints. I mean, you could be fired for that.
Yeah, when you are on probation, one complaint from a passenger could get you fired. Once you were off probation, even though we were unionized, 3 could get you fired. So that really made you remember, you know, to be a good flight attendant, to be nice, to be welcoming, to not be belligerent. I mean, sometimes it just meant you had to take a deep breath, go in the galley, collect yourself to come back out to deal with someone who was especially difficult. But we also had orchid letters, which were when people had a good experience, and those got you little perks and special things. So,
yeah. All right. So we mentioned there was an age limit for women, 32 for some, TWA was 35, but males could work into their 60s, right? And it was 1978, a former flight attendant, Lynn Rippelmeyer, became the second female pilot that TWA hired. Just one out of 25, right? Of all the female pilots.
Yeah. You know, I honestly, I've been trying to remember specifically, I do not think I saw a female captain until 1985. I, they might have been out there, but I'm saying I did see a first officer before that, but a female captain, 1985. You know, there's that wonderful Broadway play Come From Away, which is about when the planes were grounded in Canada after 9/11. And there's this great song that I urge people to just, you know, you don't have to see the play or listen to all of it. This song called Me in the Sky. And it's about a female pilot. And the struggles and the fight she had to become a pilot in the 60s and 70s.
All right, so you're going to read a passage for us, and this sort of speaks to your quest for adventure, right? So you want to read that passage for us?
Yeah. So you'll remember the first line of that book that I mentioned, How to Become an Airline Stewardess. And I love reading this passage because it answers a lot of questions people have about flight attendants in general. Like when you're on a layover, do you actually do anything? Do you get to see the place you're in? And how did it feel to be a flight attendant? You know, and I tried throughout the book to capture both the frustrations, the sexism, the overcoming sexism, but mostly the joy. So I think this kind of answers a lot of that. One June afternoon, I got a call from crew scheduling with an assignment to Lisbon, a city I had not yet visited. Excited to see a new place, even the terrible flight over, filled with angry, overly demanding passengers, didn't deter my eagerness for exploring. At least I won't have to see any of them again, I thought, as I fake smiled my goodbyes at the departure door. The whole crew felt beat up by this flight, and on the bus to the hotel, I asked if anyone wanted to get out, to go out. We needed it. No one did. So I was going to change out of my uniform, ask for recommendations at the front desk for what to see, and step out into this exotic city. In the lobby, I heard a group of passengers from my flight complaining loudly to the concierge, and I thought I would never see them again. Then I saw most of the crew changed into street clothes, heading out somewhere. One of them spotted me and looked away, embarrassed. They did have plans. I just wasn't part of those plans. I took a deep breath and walked across the lobby to the front desk. The clerk gave me a map circling the different things to do and see. My ever-present jet lag hit me as soon as I stepped into the warm sun, an almost pleasant whoosh that washed over me, leaving me a little dizzy. Luckily, there was a cafe right in front of me. I'd forgotten to write down how many escudos there were to a dollar, which was about 150 at the time. So when I went to pay for my espresso, I couldn't understand how much I owed and began just pulling out all of my foreign money. Like in a movie, a handsome man appeared beside me, flashing a big smile. He said something, "Put all of that away." He threw down some escudos and asked if I'd like to join him, pointing to a little table on the sidewalk. His name was Francisco, and he worked in advertising. "Right over there," he said. I showed him my map with all the circle things, and he folded it up and put it in his pocket. "No," he said, "I will show you my Lisbon." And he did. In the rest of my years as a flight attendant, I ventured out alone and with crew members many times. I flew thousands more miles, saw many more cities. But that day and night with Francisco in Lisbon stands out as one of the best layovers I ever had. When I was 12 and dreaming of being an airline stewardess, wasn't this what I had dreamed of? A handsome man in a foreign romantic city sweeping me off my feet and walking down any street in any city in the world and finding endless possibilities.
Mm-hmm. So you found the adventure that you were looking for, right? And obviously I know you thought it was worth it in the long run, but did you expect it to be as tough as it was?
No. I mean, I think, and I'm sure many people who dream of being a flight attendant or a stewardess had the same image I did, that you kind of glide down the aisle of a beautiful airplane handing out martinis. I don't know. I knew so little about flying. I mean, I'd had that one flight to Bermuda and one to the Bahamas. I really didn't even know that, like, there were safety things, like how you would get off that plane. I thought that there were parachutes under the seat. I mean, I was this naive 21-year-old kid from a small town in Rhode Island. And so I had a very different image. My roommate, small town kid from outside of Toledo, Ohio, said it so well. She said the day we did our first emergency evacuation training, she froze. She said, "Oh, this is a big, serious job." And, you know, you did get those doses of reality. And then, of course, dealing with people and learning how to do that was your second dose. But in training, it became clear this is not what I had imagined.
But rewarding just the same. We're talking with Anne Hood about her book Fly Girl, her time as a flight attendant in the late 1970s into the 80s. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Anne Hood. Her new book is Fly Girl, about her time as a flight attendant in the late 1970s into the 1980s. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. You sort of touched on this, but talk a little bit about how deregulation impacted flying.
Yeah, so deregulation was actually a bill presented by Supreme Court Justice Breyer before he was Supreme Court Justice Breyer, and Ted Kennedy. And the intention was good, because before deregulation, the United States government determined airfares and also where airlines could fly. So if an airline was trying to get into a new market, they might have to wait 7 years, 12 years, or maybe be denied altogether. Flying to LA before deregulation, say from Boston, was about $1,200, you know, in adjusted for inflation dollars. That's why a lot of people didn't fly. And so their intent was good, to just have sort of a more open market. And that's how we got airlines. If anybody out there remembers, like People Express, New York Air, these startups that offered $39 fares from Boston to New York, or, you know, Washington, D.C. to New York. It was almost like the Wild West of airlines once deregulation started. But what it did was it eliminated the way we used to fly and started the spoke and hub system, which we have now. So if you have flown from Boston to Miami, say, you might have to go through Charlotte on American. You might have to get off your plane, race to your connection through a giant airport. That would be the hub, you know, Tallahassee being the spoke, or St. Petersburg being the spoke, to get to like smaller markets and even larger markets. There's not as many direct flights as there used to be. So what used to be a trip to the airport and a 3-hour flight can now take 7 hours by the time you do your TSA stuff, you get to Charlotte, you connect, and get on your other flight. So it really changed the ease and comfort of flying. Many big airlines just couldn't be that competitive. They did all made all the big mistakes. That's why there's no more Continental, Eastern, United, TWA, Pan Am, all of those airlines gone because of deregulation, really. Stephen Breyer was asked if he regretted it, considering how it is to fly now. He did admit, you know, the problems that it caused, but he also said, you know, you used to get on a flight before 1978, and a businessman had a whole row of seats to himself so he could put his briefcase next to him, his jacket on the other seat. And he says, but do you really still want to pay for a seat for your briefcase? So that's the positive part of deregulation.
Yeah, there's always pros and cons. And then, of course, 9/11 changed flying. Again, remember, we used to be able to go, somebody's picking you up at the airport, they were right there at the gate when you got off. Or, you know, you could walk with your friend to their gate. I mean, it was such a different experience, right?
I think it's so hard for people who have grown up post 9/11 to imagine it even. Like, I would step off, everybody, passengers came off that jetway, in, you know, out the door, right there by the gate, right there. And there would be my dad. That's who I always think of. He always picked me up from flights. There would be my dad or the person, anybody you love, waiting there, you know, and you go right into their arms. It was lovely. That's something we lost.
Right. Yeah. And one of the things you get benefits, obviously, you can fly, right? And you can bring family members. Talk about your mom and dad. Your mom was didn't really like to fly. Matter of, as kids, I mean, wasn't just the cost. You drove places, which a lot of families did. So tell us a little bit about your mom. Yeah.
Yeah. So my dad had been a career Navy guy, and he loved to travel. And my bedtime stories from him were often about all the things he'd done and places he'd gone and the food he'd eaten. My mother, not so much. She had flown exactly twice. She didn't like it at all. Of course, she was flying alone with my toddler brother to unite with my father, who was based in Naples, Italy at the time. And she was on a Navy kind of cargo plane. It kept stopping and everybody was airsick and it was terrible. And so she was a hesitant traveler, didn't even love the car trips, you know, just was like to stay home. And here I was with this job. And as soon as I got off probation, that's when your benefits started. I took my parents, we flew first class from Logan to San Francisco. That first class flight changed her forever. She could not believe that this existed, how wonderful she felt, how probably tipsy she felt when she got off that plane. And it really did turn her into a traveler, to the point where I was living in New York City and flying international out of Kennedy Airport. My parents called and said, "Where are you going today?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I'm waiting for them to call." They got in the car, drove to my apartment, sat with me, waited for the call. The call came. I said, "Well, I'm going to Paris." They came with me. I mean, this was my mother, who didn't even like going, you know, to New York City on a drive prior to me being a flight attendant. Never mind hopping on a flight to Paris. And I was their flight attendant. It was so fun. But they didn't stay. They flew back with me the next day. So they just had this like adventure. So it, you know, my job affected them as well in a good way.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I know people always go, "Oh, do you ever meet any famous people?" Because famous people fly, right? And what was that like, you know, catering to a famous person where I'm sure they don't want to be bothered by everybody else. So you got to kind of act like they're just a regular person, which they are, but they're famous, right?
No, I mean, I remember the first famous person I had on was Diana Ross. I mean, she was pretty famous, you know, and I was just... Yeah. But I remember she got on, she had like this massive fur, maybe fake fur, but there's a lot of coat. And she just said to the head flight attendant, "Leave me alone, I want to eat, just leave me alone." She put on an eye mask, curled up and slept the whole flight. But I'm like, I'm watching Diana Ross sleep. Like, you kind of never get over certain things. There was the time I had Richard Gere on a flight. He actually must have been making a movie or something. He was back and forth a lot to LA. But I was always working in coach when he was on the flight until one time I wasn't. And dessert in first class was always ice cream sundaes. And I remember I'm making an ice cream sundae for Richard Gere, and he's got this twinkle in his eye. I mean, he knows that he's a movie star, and you know, that I'm like a little bit, "Oh, this is so exciting." And I remember when I had to ask him, "Nuts?" And I thought, oh, I just, that line, there was something about it. He just laughed appreciatively, this warm, lovely laugh. Yeah, nuts. And, you know, I would get off the plane and call my parents. Like, I just had whoever on the plane. It was so exciting.
Yeah, that's fun. All right. So some not so fun stuff was furloughs. Talk a little bit. We're talking about deregulation, airlines struggling financially. And furloughs were nerve wracking.
Yeah.
What happens when you're furloughed?
So 1980, between deregulation starting to kick in and a big oil crisis, every major airline started furloughing junior flight attendants. And what it meant was you got a month's notice or 2 weeks' notice, and it's just like, we don't need you right now, and we'll call you when we do. So very uncertain future. Of course, you collected unemployment for a certain amount of time. And when TWA didn't call back for a while, many of us went to work for startup airlines or smaller airlines. I flew for an airline called Capital, which had been a charter airline, but deregulation allowed them now to get flights and to get scheduled flights. So they were just figuring out how to do that. It was very much for passengers like flying is now, you know, the crowded planes, they jammed in a lot more people. Very different experience than flying for TWA. Let's just say I was happy when I got called back, although I was always grateful that this airline hired all of us, you know, so I'd be on a crew with a guy from Pan Am, a guy from United, more TWA people. Most of us were furloughed flight attendants. So you could find work. Many women I knew went to work for an airline that flew out of Saudi Arabia. That I was a little worried about, but there were places to keep flying if you look, but they weren't in American Airlines.
Now you talked about the more junior flight attendants who got furloughed. What was it like to be a senior flight attendant, somebody who's had experience? What are the perks of being, you get to choose your route, choose your spot on the plane? That's one of the things like people don't realize, the spot where you're, you know, working on the plane is kind of a big deal.
It's huge. Yeah. So being your seniority sort of determined your life. So if you were senior, you got to pick your routes, or you at least had a regular route and didn't have to be on reserve. But the more senior you were, the more you could choose what you wanted to do. Some senior flight attendants had kids, and so they would opt to do turnarounds, leave in the morning, be back by 6 at night, and do those several times a week. Some senior flight attendants gobbled up all the routes we were dreaming of, you know, those nonstops to Athens or Rome or whatever. And while we just were slogging away on reserve. But they also, for TWA anyway, some airlines do this differently, but for TWA, you got on the plane, the most senior person said, I would like to work in first class, or I would like to work in the galley if they didn't feel like dealing with people that day. And then the next senior chose, and the next senior chose, and the most junior ended up working the position no one kind of wanted, you know, and on international, that was typically all the way in the back in E zone, which was all smoking. And so you had your own little cone, you know, is the back, the tail of the plane. And there were, I don't know how many people, 30, and you did it alone. You just kept circling, but the smoke factor was huge. So no one wanted that.
Yeah, we forget. Yeah, there was a, like, whatever row that was where behind was smoking, in front of that was non-smoking, like that was really going to keep the smoke from the front of the, I mean, it was worse probably in the back of the plane, but I mean, that, when we think back to that, that was, you know, yeah, you could smoke on the plane. Yeah.
You could smoke on the plane.
That's one thing we're happy we don't have now.
Oh, you said it. There's a good change. Yeah. Part of our announcements, you know, welcome aboard announcements was, you know, please pay attention to the no smoking sign, which was right next to the seatbelt sign.
Yeah. Wow. So you also sometimes had some, I mean, unruly passengers, you have nice, but you also, you write about death on the plane. I mean, boy, talk about scary times. Or somebody having a heart attack and you know, they take them, you don't know what happens to them. That's intense.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when you're in training and you're getting prepared for all these things, you feel like, how can that happen? But then you consider how many miles you flew, how many flights you took, and how many passengers you met. Things were bound to happen. I say in the book, life unfolds on airplanes, and that includes those kind of emergencies. I did have a passenger die of a heart attack, and we were performing CPR on him. A friend of mine on his first flight out of training had to perform the Heimlich maneuver and save someone's life. So, I mean, those things happened. Thankfully, not every day, but you had to be prepared for them to happen, for sure.
Yeah. All right. So you also wanted to be a writer. You knew that. So also since you were young, and you used to sometimes start writing your little snippets from in the jump seat, right? So what were you, did you have a little notebook? Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, I have always been a fan of those. You know, I think they're called composition notebooks. They have that, like, you know, black, blue and white, or black and white cover in the lined papers. And I used to just carry those and write my novel. And my first novel, Somewhere Off the Coast of Maine, was written in those. I just had, I don't know, dozens of them. It was so funny. I did an event last night, and the wonderful bookstore owner, Lisa Valentino at Inkfish Books in Warren, Rhode Island, she had somewhere off the coast of Maine for sale because it's sort of, you know, here's the book she produced. She's writing Fly Girl, but this is what came out of that job. You know, yeah, I always say, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, it would seem kind of nerve-wracking, like how you keep your train of thought. All right, I'm in this jump seat for a few minutes, then I got to go do something here. I mean, how did you keep your thought process intact there?
You know, you did it more like, especially on international flights, but once you fed everybody and the lights were dim, people sleep on those or try to sleep, you know, and unless someone comes in asking for some, you know, a beverage or something, or you kind of every 20 minutes have to look and make sure everybody's okay, you know, just do a check through the airplane. Otherwise you could sit and get a good hour or so done. Yeah. And of course I was also in hotels with jet lag. I got a lot done then too.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about how the experience as a flight attendant influenced your writing.
Wow. In ways I never would have imagined. So certainly just observing human nature, watching people at their best and their worst. Absolutely. But I always think of being in the galley on my jump seat, you know, on some downtime, and you hear people talking. You really, this is a warning to everyone out there. Your voices really carry on airplanes. People don't realize it. But you just listen to how people talk to each other, what they talk about. And I picked up, I think almost every book I've written reviews comment on dialogue. And I honestly think it's because I sat there listening so much. But you know, I always think that on one plane, you might have people on their honeymoon, people going to a funeral, a family off for vacation, a couple who's getting divorced, you know, or like breaking up. All on one plane, you have all these major things going on. And how can you not learn from having to deal with all of those emotions and joys and sorrows? It's just, and that's what can imbue your writing for sure.
Yeah. So you've written books, fiction and nonfiction. Is the process the same for you or is it different?
So different. I find nonfiction so much harder because I think one of the joys of writing anything is what the writer discovers as they write. And so when you're writing nonfiction, you kind of know the story, or at least you know the facts of the story and you know the timeline. And your job is to craft it into something interesting and to learn something more about yourself and what you experienced. Whereas with a novel, you can make anything happen. You know, you're the queen of the castle and you can do anything, you know?
Yeah. And your characters sometimes take on a larger role than you expect. I think all writers say that, right?
Always.
They 100%. Keep talking to you. You're like, you're not part of the story. Oh, yes, I am.
Yeah, I killed you. No, you can't.
I'm not going anywhere. All right, so yeah, you're going to be at the Marston Mills Public Library, 2 p.m. on the 14th, and then Sandwich Public Library, May 19th at 7 p.m. And we're going to have a link with more info about that, about you and your book, at our website, capeandislands.org. Before we let you go, you got it, next year maybe you'll have another novel coming out? You're working on
it? I do. I have a new novel. Right? It's finished. Yeah, it's called The Museum of Tears. And it is, I still need to edit it, which I will get to as soon as I stop talking about Fly Girl in a month or two. Yeah. Although I'll never stop talking about Fly Girl, I hope. Yeah. But yes, it'll be sometime next year or early 2024. Yeah. But I'm really excited about the new novel.
All right. So the new book is Fly Girl, a memoir, and Hood. And always fun to talk to you. Thanks so much for being with us.
So fun. Thank you for having me.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.